availability. I can just pull another browser over. One showed me the availability of telescopes on iTelescope. And I'm just thinking, which one do I want? And now I know that T13 in Siding Springs is a color shot color.
What size scope is that? T13.
I'm not sure. It looks like it's a major refractor. Okay. Refractor, what I can remember. But it is a wonderful instrument, except right at the door.
I know which one. Isn't that a Takahashi?
Yes.
Yeah.
6-inch Tak or something? Or?
So it's. I don't know if it's that big.
Okay.
But as I say, it's a case of it is a lovely scope for color imaging. It's one shot color. And
what's a camera?
Telescopes are trained. The domes are open.
I'll have to go into iTelescope.
The audience is set.
I'm going to make a guess
now,
that it's an FLI of some
step
sort.
Step into
and not an
Event Horizon.
Yeah.
Their one shot, their OSCs are, what is it? Finger Lake. Finger Lake Instruments.
Yeah, Finger Lake Instruments. Yeah, they do some nice cameras. But I really like that. It's a wide field color Takahashi Sky 90.
Okay.
And looking at the actual image of the scope and the camera, it is a monster. It's got a monster set of radiation heat sinks.
Hey guys, you know,
as long as they don't mind it working,
you know we're on the air.
We're on the air?
What do you mean?
Oh my God, Marty, it's gone 9 o'clock, mate.
It's a good thing we're talking about telescopes.
Yes, it is.
Not our usual conversation.
Not our usual conversation, no. Go on,
guys, have a good show. I'm going to go on mute.
Thanks, Rob, our radio director. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Event Horizon here on astronomy.fm. It is now 9:02 in the evening on April the 14th, 2017, Universal Time. That would put it at 1:02, April the 15th, Saturday morning, 2017, Universal Time. So that means we're live for the next hour. And, of course, we have our astronomy.fm chat room wide open for you to come on over and join us. Go to the homepage, and you'll see where it says radio chat, or just type in astronomy.fm/chat, and you'll get to the login spot there. So come on over and join us. Obviously, we're talking about astronomy.
And you know what?
Go ahead.
The nicest thing is, I've got a reason to watch Stargazing live again. I have just, I have been, thank you, Black Project. You've put a link into the room, Sky, what? Stargazing Live and Back to the Earth, Episode 1, the Milky Way, the Australian version. Stargazing Live is an annual event on the BBC. It is 3 days of astronomy in prime time, and after the show they have a back to earth show, which is questions and answer session. And I have just been watching the Australian version on ABC. Top marks, guys. Loved the show. It was brilliant. And I am really pleased to say there is a Sheila over there who can actually keep a certain astrophysicist under control. Yeah, it was brilliant. And of course, I think on the second or third show, of course, Chris Lintott and David Malin were on there. That they are filming the show. It was shown live on Australian TV from Siding Springs, which is a hop, skip, and a jump from Sydney, Australia, near Sydney. And of course, it was brilliant. They actually had control of the AAT, the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and that was this brilliant. I was going to say something else, but I thought I was going to take a leaf out of the Starbuck, the original Starbuck from BSG, not the new one. Use one of his favorite terms, but I thought, no, I won't do that. We're live. I don't want to upset anybody. But you know what? It was fantastic. What can you say? Some terrific scenery. They were going all over the place. They went down to a star party in Tasmania, where a local group had got all the telescopes out. They had everybody there. I think they had a Barbie afterwards as well. For the uninitiated, a Barbie is what the South Africans call a baraai, and you Americans call a barbecue. And as Mark is pointing out in chat, it's a 2.3-meter telescope. 2.3 meters. Several
That's
million worth a telescope being used. And you know what? it also holds the most important thing. It took the first color image, and that was by David Malin, and that was of the Horsehead Nebula.
Yeah, nice.
But you know what? I loved the Australian version. I got bored with the UK version. I hate to say this. My main issue is, of course, it means there's no Sky at Night that month.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I thought, why can't we have both shows? So one is slightly later in the month than the other. That way we get two nice doses of astronomy, but the BBC don't see it that way, which is a shame, really, BBC. Come on, pull your finger out. Let's have a month of solid astronomy. You do it, you have three nights for stargazing live. Why not later on in the month show the sky at night? You know what? That used to be my holler of a month, the sky at night. It still is. It's not quite the show it used to be. There are a few people missing from it that I really felt did the show a lot of good. But hey, that's life.
So Sky at Night was your favorite show, huh?
It was my favorite astronomy. It was the.
It should be astronomy.fm, Nick. You say it's your second favorite.
TV, Marty. This is TV I'm talking about, not radio. Of course, obviously, astronomy.fm is my favorite radio show.
Radio has better images than TV.
Maybe.
Your imagination is always better than reality.
Yes, I'm being told there are a few videos on YouTube I'm going to love. I can't wait. I can't do it tomorrow. Because I'm recording Comet Watch tomorrow.
And it's going to be broadcast Sunday?
No, it'll probably be broadcast Wednesday after Pirates, Marty. That's the way
okay.
it is. That's, okay. In fact, we've got two guests this month. We have got Chris Wyatt, who has got a humongous logbook of comet observations.
Okay.
And we have Richard Kowalski from the Catalina Sky Survey. So not only have we had Richard Hill from the Sky Survey, now we got one of his colleagues on this on Comet Watch. So we are having a lot of fun with that show.
A lot of comments up. Kind of nice comments out there right now, actually.
Yeah, 41P is nice. V2 Johnson is still looking good. 45 is still looking good. Lovejoy is still doing an excellent show. And, of course, the new Pan-STARRS is doing fairly well. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm going to be honest. My advice is if you're going to remote telescope for C2015 ER61 Pan-STARRS, do it when it's deep night. Because the closer to dawn you get, the you're not going to get the picture you want, the image
you
want.
Is it heading closer to the sun, from our point of view?
It probably
or away
is,
from
actually.
It?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember because I think either 41 or 45 has actually gone around and starting to come back.
Okay.
And they are dimming. Lovejoy's beginning to dim a little bit, but we are still holding out because some of Terry's observations and some of the other observations show it may actually still be brightening.
Mm-hmm.
So the new Lovejoy could surprise us all. Johnson had an outburst, and 71P had an outburst. Now, 71P is faint. To be honest, even with iTelescope and using their Premier platform, which I think costs you about 100 points to image on, it's very, very faint. Yeah. And it's a 10-minute plus exposure. 10 minutes.
71P is Clark. It's listed at about 12. Half magnitude right now, so yeah, it's pretty faint.
Yeah, it is getting fairly faint, and it's causing a lot of problems, even if you're using professional grade instruments.
Yes,
but you know what? If you're unsure if you got it, use a program like Astrometrica, use SIMBAD, because they will help you confirm whether you've nabbed it or not. Yes, I know my picture got it. I know where it is. I forgot to ring it, but I still published because, to be honest, you need to get those pictures out there. They're very important. There is a lot of packer work going on these comets. They want your pictures. And I know I've got to go into a couple of packer groups and post like crazy because I have been using at least two different telescopes, or three or four, actually, because I don't care. Whichever's free on iTelescope, I will jump on and I will take my images.
Would you know if iTelescope is capable of tracking on the comet itself?
Yes, I believe that's what they're actually doing in a lot of cases.
Okay.
And on one of my images, I have got a really sharp nucleus and tail, so they must be tracking on the comet. That's the only way you're going to do it.
You can tell if the stars are trailed, then you know they're tracking on the comet.
Yeah. So there is a slight trailing in some of my images.
The stars. Okay.
But
that should be a good thing then.
Yeah, it is a good thing.
The reason for that, everyone out there listening, is that some comets, depending on how close they are, the closer they are to the Earth, will move faster compared to the background stars. So if you point your telescope at the background stars when you're taking a picture and you keep pointing on the background stars, your comet will actually become elongated. Now, you don't want that. You want to build up the light of the comet itself, so you have to track on the comet itself, even though the stars will get elongated and start trailing. But the comet, all the light will collect together on the comet, and you get a nice, bright, perfectly shaped image of the comet, even though the stars aren't round anymore. But that's perfectly okay. It gives you a better image of the comet. And that's, again, the closer the comet is to the Earth, the more it appears to move, and the farther away from the Earth it is, the less it appears to move.
Now, one of the interesting things is, when Terry got his latest comet, he was using software he'd written himself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to – okay, a little bit of self-promotion here. If you go to the first Comet Watch special, which is Terry and his sixth comet, he talks about the software. At the moment, he is still working on it. It's not really ready to be put out there because it's really built around his telescopes. But what he's thinking of doing, and what he told us, was that he's maybe thinking of putting it online so you can use it online instead of downloading it and putting it on your own computer, which I think is actually a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to save you some computer cycles. It might put your bandwidth use up a bit, but it's going to be a trade-off. And at least that way, Terry can keep an eye on the software and see where any tweaks are needed. And I have to admit, I am really dead impressed with what he's been doing.
Nice.
Which kind of segues into something we were thinking of discussing. Let's go for it. Modifications to your own telescopes. How many of you out there do it?
Whether you buy commercial scope or build your own scope, and when do you modify or upgrade type of things? So
could
be lots of things, like a Dobsonian telescope. It's fairly large if you want it to track the stars. You can get a couple devices. One's called a derotator. Mm-hmm. So if your mount's driven, altitude and azimuth, which means up and down and side to side. So if you have motors that will drive it up and down side to side, when you try to take a picture of that type of telescope, the stars actually start to circle. It's just the dynamics of the way the Earth turns and where you are on the Earth that'll do that. So you can get a device that you put on your focuser, and it actually counter-rotates your camera so that it keeps the stars from trailing. And the other one's called a Ponce mount. It's a platform that you put under your telescope that the large Dobsonian can sit on, and it has a drive mechanism that actually turns it into an equatorial. So let's just begin. Now, what are you actually doing with your scope right now?
Well, what I've done, the first thing I've got is a GPS unit for my Celestron.
Okay.
Because, to be honest, if you want to take it somewhere, you've got to carry a handheld GPS. You've got to program your mount when you get to wherever you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're going to a star party, that can be a pain in the royal. Every time you've got to program it, particularly if you can go home, then you've got to change the programming. So what Celestron did, they actually provided a purpose-built GPS mount, which plugs into the actual mount, and you plug the handset into either the GPS mount or back into your German equatorial. So this now will automatically update and tell your mount exactly where in the world you are, what the time is. Everything's done. So no matter where you go with it,
there you are.
Don't have to sort things out. Now, depending on how you want to do it, I bought the Celestron piece of kit because that works nicely. I know it's not going to cause problems interfacing. So that's why I did it that way. The other thing I'm starting to do is I'm upgrading the focuser. Now, I have a DSLR.
Mm-hmm.
And that means because I have, if you have either a Canon or a Nikon, you can buy a program called Backyard EOS for Canon, Backyard mm-hmm. Nikon for Nikon DSLRs. The program itself, if you have its your scope set up, will focus the scope for you. So you basically you run a pair of you run a cable from your USB to the camera and to the mount.
If your focuser is interfaced with through the mount.
Yeah. So what I'm doing, I'm actually going to a company called Moonlight. That's MoonLite. They actually build a complete set. They have a complete setup. You can actually choose which parts you need. So for me, it's going to be a 2-inch electronic focuser, a DC stepping motor, and a dual control port. Why a dual control port? Very simple. Eventually, I'm talking to a very good friend of mine, Ryan Goodson. He builds Dobbs. Not only does he build Dobbs, he builds big Dobbs. So the Dob will have servo cap, which will also take care of derotation issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a Moonlit electronic focuser built in. With the motor and with the dual port controller, Backyard EOS will now talk and focus to the motor. It will automatically focus the camera for me. So it will move the whole thing in and out to get a properly focused image.
The way that it generally does that is when you image a star, if it's a little out of focus, the starlight is spread out, and then the light on each pixel is actually a little bit dim. And when you focus it, that light starts coming together, so it goes into less and less pixels, and the less and less pixels actually will show a higher pixel light value on them. So basically, when it's in focus, you'll get the maximum amount of value, which is the maximum amount of light on that one pixel, and that will tell you that's focused. Now, if it goes past that point, then the maximum value will start to go down. That means it went the wrong way. It'll have to go back the other way again until it finds the maximum value of light hitting one pixel, and that tells it it's in focus.
And, of course, the really nice thing is if you're in a warm room and you don't, A, have to go out into the cold, and, B, the most important thing is it stops shake, mm-hmm. your mount getting shook when you focus. And that is the biggest problem, because you can perhaps focus it up nicely to what you think is right, but you may not actually have a good focus. The software will actually do everything for you. You can look on your screen,
mm-hmm.
and you can actually physically, using your keyboard or a mouse, change the focus. Or if you trust the system totally, you can let the system do that.
That's one thing about, I was talking earlier about electronic focusers, just by pushing a button, using the motor to make your focuser go up and down, that means your hand's not touching. Every time your hand touches the focuser, it shakes a little bit. For low power views, no problem. As soon as you start getting up high power views, one little touch makes the whole thing shake back and forth. In fact, it shakes so much you can't tell when it's in focus, because the shaking overdoes the focusing, and so you really can't tell because it's like constantly shaking, and then you let go, and then maybe it was right, maybe it's not, so you have to go touch the button, shake it again. You have a lot more guessing game that way. So if you can just push a button and go through the focus up and down, in and out, and then you can really tell which way is properly focused, and it doesn't bounce around that way. Doesn't it help with atmospheric bouncing? That's a different story.
No, but then that you deal with in your processing.
Yeah.
But the really nice thing is, of course, that means if you're using planetarium software like the Sky X,
mm-hmm.
Or if you're just out there and you're looking to image craters, or you're trying to go for some fuzzies, it takes a lot of grief out of the whole procedure. And to be honest, if you're taking astronomical photographs, you should not be physically pressing a shutter button.
Right.
You should be using a remote release.
Yes.
And of course, everything is not only is your camera connected through the USB, so is the focusing devices. So everything is now integrated and totally under control. And of course, it also means if you live in the snow zone like me and Marty do, it means you're nice and warm too.
Now, one of the old techniques, well, again, the same thing. Even with the old SLR cameras that took film, yeah, just pushing down on that shutter button on the top of your camera, push the camera, push the telescope, and shook it back and forth. So most like your view is blurry just from touching it. An old issue used to be that there was a mirror in the camera that would allow you to look through the lens, and you'd focus that way, a little bit of issue that way. But when you actually push the shutter button, even with a remote, the mirror would slap up and shake the camera. So in order to take a long exposure, you had to actually put like a piece of cardboard in front of your telescope, hold it there, open the shutter, let the mirror slap, lock it open, pull the card away, let the light go to it for however many minutes it was, and then put the card back in front of it, release the camera, the mirror would slap down, shake the camera, but it's okay because you got it covered. And you improved your photographs that way. Now you don't get the mirror slap, but you definitely do get when you touch that shutter button, it shakes the whole camera.
I think one of the nicest thing is we have such a wonderful opportunity as amateurs. Literally, I know. Yeah, I do say this, and I do mean this. We have professional toys.
Yes.
Literally, we can do. Within a lot of degrees, everything a professional astronomer can do. And the best thing is, of course, at the end of the day, we have the time. We have no worries about scheduling on instruments.
And
we
the equipment.
And the equipment. We have no worries about finance, getting an appropriation to rent time on Mount Palomar. We can have Mount Palomar in the back garden these days. Seeing the size of instruments a lot of amateurs have, 20-inch mirrors are not uncommon anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the SCTs have 16-inch plus mirrors,
mm-hmm.
and they've been available for at least 10 years.
16-inch, I think 20 or 30, actually.
Yeah. People like Mead and Celestron have been punching these guys out for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's all high-quality glass.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, we have the time, we have the technology. Sounds like a bit of a skit from the $6 Million Man, I know.
I was just thinking the same thing, yep.
Great minds think alike, huh, Marty?
Uh-huh.
But as I say, what your telescope becomes is down to you. What do you want it to do? I have set targets. I'm going to be using my Newtonian for comets a lot. Now, the DOB will get used for planetary work. It's going to get used a lot for lunar work. Well, everybody complains, oh, we've only got 2 weeks of no moon. Well, I'm going to use the other weeks of moon to look to jump around craters, look for rills, hunt for domes, and image them. And you know what? The moon is not dead. It is still, in some degrees, being changed. There are impactors and stuff. If you really are keen, you can run your telescope with a video camera that has got a time reference and a GPS feed into the image, and you can look for these things. You can't do it around full moon. We're looking at when the moon is a waxing crescent, first quarter, last quarter, and waning crescent.
Mm-hmm.
But be unique, because you need that moon dark part in order to catch the flash in a lot of cases. So there is so much work you can do. And let's face it, we're told we're going to Mars. Well, we're going to test the kit for Mars on the moon. So we're going to have to go back. The astronauts who go back to set up the bases to test this kit, they're going to need the observations. They're going to need to know how frequent hits are. They're going to need to know where is the quietest area, where is the heaviest bombardment still happening. All right, it's not as great as it was about 4 or 5 million years ago, but it still happens.
And you probably want to stay away from that big square black obelisk, too.
Yeah, I think that's buried in Tycho, isn't it, still?
Something like that, yeah.
And then keep away from computers called HAL.
That's right.
But as I say, the equipment to update a commercially bought telescope is there. Buy a decent telescope from somebody who's reputable, Celestron, Mead, Skywatcher, and then think what you want to do with it. Think how you can modify it, adapt it, and then think how you're going to have the enjoyment from sitting there, from getting these pictures. Hey, I tell you what, I love sharing my astro pictures, whether they're from remote telescopes, or there's stuff I've just done very simply with just a camera and a spotting scope, or if I'm spending the time to really get a super, super in-depth image of, say, a crater or a rill. Mm-hmm. You just can't, but you can't beat the fun. And to be honest, when you get people who are considered to be the bee's knees in the imaging business saying, "Hey, that was a good snap of the good image of the comet you got," that's when you know you've made it. Mm-hmm. Astronomy as a hobby is what you make it, really. I like to mix it with at the scope. My eyes don't let me do visual anymore because I need varifocal lenses. It's difficult to use an eyepiece. That's fine. I'll stick a camera on it. I've got two cameras already. I've got a video camera from Orion, a ColorShot Mark IV. I've got my DSLR. Maybe eventually I'll actually get a CCD for the really faint stuff. Mm-hmm. But this hobby is really what you make it. And you can even do simple things. You can set up an all-sky camera. So by day, you can be recording the weather. And at night, you can be looking, you can have it pointed upwards, and you can be looking for meteors, for fireballs. And again, if you have a camera that can take a GPS signal, you can record it on your computer, onto a hard drive. And when you get one, you can send it in. You can report it to the UK Fireball Survey. You can send it to the International Meteor Organization. Most countries have their own patrols for meteors and for fireballs. They just want your observations. You can even do it with your mobile phone, your smartphone. You can fit it. You can put an app on it that when you see one, you can just run up the app. It will take the GPS from your phone. It will record everything. And as long as you just need to keep the fireball in view of your camera.
Keep up with those organizations too. Yeah. You might find something that a really big one came down, and if it comes down in your area, that would be a good chance to go looking for meteorites.
Well, yeah, take a leaf out of the Notkin book.
Mm-hmm.
Get a metal detector. Learn how to tell the difference between a common piece of rock and a piece of space rock. Have some fun. Enjoy it.
And a beer can.
Yeah, you can do that too.
No, I mean, you gotta know how to tell the difference between a rock and a beer can.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you know what? There is just so much to this hobby. It's not just boring old guys with beards down between their knees and bald heads in lab jackets.
That's ZZ Top, I think.
That's a nice one, ZZ Top. Yeah, I can just see those guys in lab jackets looking at the stars,
mm-hmm.
passing the Jack Daniels.
That'd work like a regular star party.
Yeah, that's true. Too, I know, been to a few like that. we get till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and either the clouds are coming in, and it's like, what do we do now?
Yeah, I recommend if you get, you know, falling down intoxicated, you try to, you know, land on your back so you can still look up for meteors.
Yeah, that's always a way to do it.
Uh-huh.
But you know what? As I say, and these are social occasions. Get to know your fellow astronomers. Share stories. Share ideas. Because, you know, you never know. You might learn something new. And I think that's one of the greatest things about star parties is they are a learning experience. If you've had problems imaging something, bring it up in conversation. Yep. Because you can guarantee there's going to be somebody that says, "Ah, I know how to fix that."
I think I've thrown this one out there before. I'll still throw it out there again. Using the program called Nebulosity to operate a Apogee U16 camera, for some reason it won't do one-to-one binning. It'll only do two-by-two binning. So, and everything we found out, looked it up, forums and stuff like that, no answer. So they think there's just some conflict between the two devices, organizations, companies, whatever. Is it a licensing thing? What? Does anybody have any real answers? Is there a workaround? Why I can't get Nebulosity to work a Apogee U16? If anybody come up with an answer, please let me know in some chat room sometime here.
Well, yeah, come in and talk to us. The whole we do this because we want to hear from you as well. Come into our chat room. If you're listening to the repeat, then you've obviously got the links from the show earlier. Mm-hmm. Come and talk to us. Come in and see if we're about. Marty and I do actually come in here when we're not live. I come in most evenings for a short while to see what's going on and just to keep an eye on things. But if you've got an idea for us or you think you've got an answer, come in, talk to us. If you see one of us, tap us on the shoulder and say, hey, can you send this on to Marty? I'll be too happy to.
Put it on the Strami.fm Facebook page.
Yeah.
And then somebody there can, you know, contact us later that it's out there, something like that too. So
come to the Space Pirates Facebook page.
Yep.
Send a message.
Yep.
We do reply.
Unfortunately, my email on Strami.fm homepage does not work.
We'll have to
at least get another. We've been trying to get fixed, but it's like too far deep in there to not fix. So, but I'll try to get it. We'll see if somebody can put another email address out there.
Create a Gmail account, Marty, or something.
I've got a Space Pirate Gmail account.
Tell you what, put it into chat and I'll put it into the notes. How's about that?
Okay. In the chat room here?
Yeah, in the chat room here right now.
All right.
Because unfortunately, Starstorm is not feeling very well, so she's not with us tonight. So I'm dealing with the links. I'm getting them all down as quick as I can.
All right, here you go.
Okay. Ah, I see it there. Space Pirates.
That's right. AARGH@gmail.com.
In fact, I will cut and paste the whole thing into the notes right now. So it will be, you can see in the notes, Sky Guide Marty, Space Pirates, @gmail.com.
Right. Yep. But I don't get to that website, that email address all that often. So it'd be better if you let me know, like on the Facebook page, then I'll check the email, stuff like that.
That's the way it works, folks. The more you put in, if you come up with ideas and information, share it with us. We'll put it on there. Like Black Projects did earlier with the Aussie version of Stargazing Live. Brilliant show.
Yep.
I did watch the UK version as well. It was live from there.
Okay. By the way, we're halfway through our program here on the Event Horizon on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is now 9:33 in the evening on April the 14th, 2017. Friday night for us here in the eastern portion of North America, with a little bit of daylight savings time. So universal time, that would put it at April the 15th, 2017 at 1:34 now in the morning. So we're live with our chat room. So come on over to the chat room at astronomy.fm/chat, or you'll find it on the homepage too. Come on over.
Yeah, come over, join in, talk to us,
mm-hmm.
say things to us. We'll even mention you here. So I see in our chat room tonight, Glenn T, Optronics, Crowtown Skies, ASJR
581.
Thank you. And In the Quiet Wood, as well as myself and Marty. Get yourself on the air, get your name on the air, mate. That's what it's for.
Yeah, and you could converse with us directly through our chat room.
You can even ask us questions, and we'll do our best to answer them.
That's right. Or at least we'll give you, at least we'll give you funny answers if we can't come up with the right one.
Yeah, we'll do our best.
All right. Looking at the sky lately, Venus has moved back into the morning skies, by the way.
So has the moon.
So has the moon. No, moon's in the evening sky.
No.
Oh, wait. That's right, because we're coming up on the last quarter. We're past full moon now. by a couple days or something like that. And we're coming up on last quarter next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So it's still kind of a big bright moon out there. Sunday the 16th, we're going to have Saturn will be 3 degrees south of the moon. That's pretty much all that's notable. Well, next Thursday, Mercury is going to be in inferior conjunction. Now, as I've talked about before, like shooting Venus at inferior conjunction, and this time it was not too bad because it was like 7 degrees away from the sun, no big deal. Well, Mercury, I was going to thought, oh, maybe I'd get Mercury sometime, but no, Mercury's only 2 degrees from the sun. Not going to try to view it during the daytime when it's that close. Not
and
a good thing at all.
Good reason for that. Never, ever look at the sun through binoculars or a telescope.
Without eyes, proper filters.
Without proper filters, agreed, because your eyes are made of water, and the concentrated sunlight will boil them up, and we don't want that, do we, now?
Well, I think it'll burn your retina through the water before you have to worry about the fluid boiling up and exploding your eyeballs.
There was a video on YouTube.
Was there?
An astronomer made a very graphic video of what happens if you look at the sun through a telescope.
A cow eye? Did he use a cow eye or sheep eye?
He used pig's eyes.
Pig's eyes? Okay.
Yeah, it was like cooked.
So if somebody says it's okay to look at the sun through a telescope, you go, yeah, in a pig's eye.
Absolutely. Or with a pig's eye.
With a pig's eye. One tiny, tiny, tiny little sunspot on the sun right now, barely there, smaller than the Earth, looks maybe like about the size of the moon. So you definitely would have trouble actually seeing the sunspot on the sun. There's kind of a coronal hole that's opened up, especially then there was some material released from a prominence that kind of broke away. We're supposed to get some increased activity. Solar wind speed is actually down from a few days ago. It was around 400. Now it's only 346 kilometers per second. Density is up a little bit. It was less than one proton per cubic centimeter. Now it's almost 5 protons per cubic centimeter. So still waiting to see what happens. If we get some activity come out of that coronal hole and prominence eruption.
Well, I can tell you, thanks to my handy-dandy ham radio app, that the X-ray level is at A5.9. There is a radio aurora at the latitude of 65.6 degrees. It's for VHF transmissions, basically. We are talking very high-frequency stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Solar flare probability is about 30%. The geomagnetic field is quiet. Signal noise level from the sun is about S1 or S2. So it is fairly quiet, but don't make the mistake of thinking that it is very, very quiet, because past few weeks we had one weekend where the sun kicked off at least four M-class flares, one after the other.
With two major sunspot groups.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, everybody says we're going into solar minimum. Yes, we are officially, but our star is a variable star. It's a G3 yellow dwarf, rather. Dwarf. Oh, my God, I've got Cat and Listy on the brain.
Red dwarf.
It's big. Yeah. And it's a G3 yellow dwarf. It is a variable star. Sometimes it is a quiet, placid star. Nothing really happens. And then it decides it's had enough of being quiet. And then, by gosh, it kicks off. We haven't had any serious X-class flares for a while. We shouldn't. However, we just don't know when we'll get the next one. And you know what? This is something else you could do as a project. You could even go into school and show the kids this using projection. Or take a solar scope in. There are some very good ones on the market, and they're quite reasonably priced. So you have a way of doing astronomy during the day. Go solar.
There you go. Oh, where was I going to go to next year?
Maybe you're slewing into it.
Maybe I am.
Sorry, Marty.
Oh, well. Juno Orbiter is still circling around Jupiter. I think it's about ready for its fourth pass come up. So we'll see what those images of Jupiter really close up, a couple thousand miles away. So far, they've been pretty cool. Cassini still circling Saturn, getting ready to pass between the planet and the inner ring. We'll see if it survives, and eventually it's going to be plunged into the atmosphere of Saturn. I don't know if it's, how much longer it's before it gets plunged. Do you know, Nick?
I think it's got a few more orbits left. I know it's got quite a significant science project still to do. Mm-hmm. However, they are being quite careful with the propellant available. They didn't quite get the orbit they wanted originally. Okay. So it means it's being tweaked. They are looking after the spacecraft because they want to use it for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go to a NASA app. It's called EYES, where you can actually see exactly what's going on in the solar system and where all the space probes are. They even have the locations for Voyager and Pioneer. So have a look at it. It is a long download. It is a big app. And it is best viewed in full screen.
And all the buzz lately is about potential water, life, on some of the moons in the solar system, that they're starting to ramp that up a little bit more now. I think, was it Enceladus?
Enceladus, Europa.
That's the latest one, yep. But they're actually talking about sending a probe there and check for a little bit of biology in the water underneath the ice there.
No, I'm just going to go quiet for a little while. I'll let you speak for a little while, Marty, because I'm going to pull up a link for that app because we've been asked for it in the chat room.
Okay. Let me give you the up down. The up down. What's going on with NASA launches and stuff like that? So let's see where we're at here. Wait for my page. All right, let's see. We got on April the 18th, the launch of an orbital cargo resupply mission to the space station. So that's why I say always check on heavens above and find out where the space station is going to be during that time. And not during the launch, obviously, that's pointless, but find out when the cargo ship is actually going to connect to the space station. And just before that, you can see if you can actually see both of them as separate objects. On April the 20th, launch of Expedition 51 crew to the space station. So again, trying to figure out when they're actually going to connect and then be able to see two separate objects close together. That's pretty cool. I haven't actually looked for the space station in quite a while. I got to go check it and see what's flying over. And something that's on my list of imaging is the space station.
Yeah, it is a good challenge because it is a fairly rapidly moving object. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, I do occasionally like to go outside. Now, when I go outside to look at the space station, I don't care if it's clouded because I take a portable radio. Mm-hmm. And I tune it to 2 meters, and it's a specific frequency for the repeater on board the ISS. So I'm listening out for the Morse ident on that repeater. And, of course, if I point an aerial at a Yagi, a handheld aerial, I can actually access it and try and get a QSO whilst the station's going overhead. Sometimes you can get really, really lucky. If there's an astronaut by the 2 meter radio on board the ISS, which is currently in the Russian module, you might actually get someone come back to you, say hello, and you can get a QSL card. A QSL card, for those who don't know, is basically a postcard. It has a nice picture on it, and it has some information about the conversation you had. It's a signal report, time, and date. And a lot of them are very collectible, certainly the ones from the ISS, because they are hard to get.
Speaking of the ISS, who was just watching on Facebook? Is it Mick Nichols? He was going to try to look for space station flying across the sun from his location. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. That's pretty soon, actually. That's another project you can actually do if you want to see space station. Actually image it crossing the face of the sun. Yeah. And you can go to a program called CalSky, CalSky. Put in your parameters, your location, stuff like that, and it will calculate. And it can even send you notices of when the space station is going to fly in front of the sun, planets, things like that.
The moon.
The moon, yeah.
I have seen some really excellent pictures of the ISS transiting the moon. And they are proper pictures of it. It's not someone who's photoshopped a whacking great picture of the ISS on the moon where it almost obscures it, and everybody points them and says, Yeah, right. This is actually, you have to look hard at it to see it. The moon is good because it does actually throw the station into relief. On some occasions, I have seen the images that show the Canadian, the Canada 2 arm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's even harder to spot.
Yeah, one of my projects is imaging the space station. I've got another one too, Venus. I did, remember I said I did image it in inferior conjunction. Yeah. Now my next project is to image it during superior conjunction. So when Venus is on the far side of the sun, mm-hmm. during conjunction time, and that of course would be another daytime observation.
Yeah.
So instead of a thin crescent, it'll be a round ball.
And you know what? You can actually image the planets. You can image the moon and most of the giant planets very easily during the day. You mm-hmm. can even locate stars during the day. Some yes. people have good enough vision they can see them with naked eye. But if you use your telescope and you go to, then you can actually get some very, very good images. To be honest, I have no problems with going out in daylight to image the moon because it makes setting up my camera even more easier.
Yeah, that's something that can help too. If the moon's out there in the daytime, you can actually focus on it.
Yeah.
And then leave your telescope set, don't move it, and then when it comes into nighttime, you know, it's focused for like a faint object or something like that.
Yeah. But if you're going to use a DSLR and you haven't got it wired into your computer for USB. I keep thinking about under British skies.
USB.
USBs, yes. Is to use a remote. But you can get them. They're very cheap these days. It's just a button or a timer, and you can either set it to go off on a time delay, or you can just do it yourself. The greatest thing is you don't wobble your mount at all, and you can get away with using a very basic photographic tripod as well. So get it focused up, stand back, leave a nice bit of slack in the cable, and just take your pictures that way. It works. It's fun. And you know what? If this is daytime and the moon is waning, you could do this as a school project. You mm-hmm. could take school kids out. You could show them the moon. You can take the laptop, set it all up. So instead of looking through the image finder on your camera, you can have it on your laptop screen. I'll tell you what, that is one great way to perhaps get kids into science, is to show them the moon during the day. You can do it with Jupiter too, with a telescope.
Yep.
And of course, binoculars are perfect if you can keep an eye on it and you can just make the minute adjustments as the moon moves around the sky. But you know what? It is a good way to do astronomy during the day. Mm-hmm. I don't know why a lot of people don't do it. It just seems senseless to me to ignore the fact you've got a clear sky, you've got a nice moon, or you can probably find Jupiter very easily. You can then image or see it or observe it. You're wasting good time.
Another fun one is when Venus is a little ways away from the sun, and then the moon happens to get really close to Venus, and that happens during the daytime, so it's not too hard to find the moon in the daytime, and then you look right next to it in the correct direction, the correct distance, and see Venus right there, done naked eyed. It's really easy to point it out to other people that way too. Great way of finding Venus in the daytime is when it's right next to the moon.
So there are tons of ways you can turn what was really a nighttime hobby into a daytime hobby. One of the things I plan to do once I retire, if I ever retire, with my kit list, I'm not going to be retiring for a while yet, but the thing is, it means I can have more time. I can potter around my garden, do my vegetables, then get the scope out, use it during the day. And you never know. You might convince the kid who is perhaps interested but has never had the chance to look through a telescope to do it, get hooked. And this may be the kid that finds something vitally important,
mm-hmm.
Like maybe an Earth-threatening near-Earth object. But you know what? Unless you can give these kids the chance to see through a telescope or through binoculars an astronomical image, an astronomical object during the day, sometimes they'll never get the chance. A lot of schools don't have the physics program to allow them access to remote telescopes. UK schools have the Liverpool telescopes, so they set things up. They program mission, they program imaging runs, they get their images, and they discuss them in class as part of a physics lesson. Most of the time, schools treat astronomy as perhaps 30 minutes of physics, and that's about it, which is sad, really, when you could actually, on a decent day, the moon is waning, you could go out there, set up a telescope, you can look at the moon, you can crater hop, you can look at the mare, you can then perhaps set up a solar telescope, even more physics then. Solar physics, which is probably another good way to get kids interested. If the kids are interested, the teachers, in a lot of cases, will then put the actual stuff in place to do it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So go in as an amateur. If you happen to have a kid in a high school or a comprehensive or whatever, see if they would be – talk to the teachers. Get them interested. Get them to have you come in with a telescope. Have them give you an internet link or access so you can perhaps log in to something like Siding Springs during the day in the US or the UK. It's nice in Australia. The telescopes are up and running. You could actually then use your iTelescope account. You can actually set everything up so they can see what's going on. And the nicest thing about iTelescope is you can see the previous image. Whilst you're doing your imaging run, you can actually click on a link which will show the image in a new tab. That will bring up the last image that was taken on the telescope. And you can also show the all-sky cameras.
Those are fun.
Yeah, they're fun because like the one for Sierra in Sierra Mountain scopes, they show a decent bit of the surrounding area. You get to see the pine trees in the all-sky. In Australia, sometimes you actually get to see wildlife. I've seen kangaroos and a few other things in the all sky during the day, and even more at dawn and dusk.
I used to like the Perth Observatory all sky camera. That would show me a huge swath of the southern skies, and I tried to pick out constellations from that because I was not, here in the northern hemisphere, not used to look at the southern skies. This is like live images of the southern skies, and I was trying to learn the southern constellations just from that all-sky camera they had.
And if you've got a really cracking good planetarium program, before you actually log into the scope, you can show them the sky or where they're going to be taking the image from. So you can pull up the southern skies. You can let them see the band of the Milky Way and some of the beautiful sights. And then when they go to image what they want, so they could be going for a galaxy, a nebula, a comet, or whatever, they will then see it in situ. They'll get an idea of what they would see if they was there. And we've had a new member join the chat room. Hello, Nexi, welcome to the show. Glad you could make it. Literally, if you can do outreach like that, you may get a whole bunch of kids doing something that will, as young adults, that will keep them busy and out of harm's way. There's an old joke for astronomers and radio amateurs that they're always too broke to buy drugs because they're too busy buying equipment. Let's face it, I admit, a decent telescope, a decent camera, a decent mount, it costs money. And then you're going to buy eyepieces, you're going to be upgrading on a reg quite often, or you may decide, this is the upgrades I need to do that will keep me busy for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my telescope for 15 years. I've decided I want to upgrade it. I want to do more with it. And so I'm investing in it. And you know what? At the end of the day, you've got fun. You've got enjoyment. And you don't worry about what's going on somewhere else. Yeah, I agree with Quiet in the Woods. Start with binoculars. It's a great way to learn a sky. Get a star map. Learn to constellation hop. Learn to star hop. Because if you know the constellations, then when you see something in a constellation that doesn't look right, you know you're onto something. Particularly if it's a comet, then you've got a better chance of being right. Now, everybody wants to discover a comet or an asteroid or something, but you need to be accurate with your information. You need to know that area of the sky like it's the back of your own hand or the front of your hand, because you're going to send a report in. I saw this here. This is the coordinates, yada, yada, yada. If you know that constellation that well, you know when there's something new there. It could even be a supernova that's been spotted. If you get it in first to people like the IAU, to the Minor Planet Center, your name goes on it. You might find that you've got three people simultaneously submitting and getting there. You get three names on it. That's why some of our comets have long names. It's because three or four people have got their observations in. They all tied for the arrival. So the MPC says, right, this is going to be now comet 2017 P whatever, yada, yada, and yada, because those are the names of the people who reported it. They made it first in. Their names get on it.
When my luck is, I will discover the comet that's going to crash into the Earth right where I'm at.
Maybe. Maybe you'll be the guy that gives the warning. Okay, this is a private little beef. I am sick and tired of hearing about Nirabu. I'm sick and tired of brown dwarfs going to hit us and that NASA is covering it up. That is the biggest load of tosh ever. There are so many private telescopes around the world aimed up at the sky at any given time of the day or night that anything will be seen. And you know what? The Catalina Sky Survey makes regular announcements of stuff it's spotted. They can't hush it up because they're not allowed to. So NASA isn't going to hide the fact that there's a humongous comet coming right dead onto us, or there's a rogue planet. We're all going to know about it. And if they don't say something, somebody like myself, Marty, or maybe Quiet in the Wood will be out on Facebook yelling about it to get the professionals to look at it.
Speaking of brown dwarfs, here's an article of astronomers identify a massive 10 billion year old brown dwarf. Now, massive and dwarf are kind of the opposite. So I need to read this article. Let me pop it into our chat room here. And
just
go ahead.
You a second. Crow wants to know what's on my favorite cameras. I love my Canon DSLR. I've got a Rebel XI. I love using that for astronomy. I also happen to like the Attic range, but that's just a personal thing because most of my friends who image use Attics.
So I'm still trying to find why they're calling this a massive brown dwarf, because brown dwarfs are generally small stars. And they're small because they don't have enough stuff in them. And they don't have enough stuff in them to fully go into nuclear fusion. So basically it's just gravity heating them up. They usually don't stay hot for very long either. 10 billion years? I don't know. Now, something like a very small, more of like a red dwarf, that can last a long time because that actually has fusion going on at a very, very slow rate. So it can, those can last a long time. But a brown dwarf being massive, something kind of opposite there.
Hey, Marty, have you seen the tricorder anywhere?
Have I seen the tricorder anywhere? Let me check the color of my shirt. I'm not wearing a red shirt anywhere, so
that's good. That's good.
Pretty soon, we're not quite ready to get out of here yet, but we're getting pretty close.
Yeah, I bet the captain's going to be getting antsy fairly quickly. So, we got to start putting our science kits away, so that we can actually beam out as soon as possible. So.
So let's thank everybody in our chat room for being here tonight, especially the regulars that have been here. Really appreciate you being here. Don't forget, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours, so you can always pick it up later if you missed part of it. And there's more programming coming up after the Event Horizon 2.
USS Miranda, this is the away team. Captain Savick, we're ready to beam up.
We are ready to beam up. We hope that you've enjoyed. How about Jim Beam? I'm ready for some Jim Beam is what I'm ready for. This program has been released under Creative Commons. That's another story. That's for a little bit later. All right. Time for us to get out of here.
For After Dark.
That's right. Astronomy. All right, we're heading out of here.
You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section. and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.